Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, March 31st, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever learned in my over 46 years of doing therapy. These tools are gratefully available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the red and white bullseye or the link in the upper left-hand corner of most pages that says Start Here, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for the past 16-plus years to improve the quality of my life and relationships. And turn any negative emotional state into an infallible part of my internal guidance system. So you can download that chapter of that book and read about it. You can also download the actual worksheet process absolutely free. It's just a PDF file. You click on it, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. And you can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have been stepped through that worksheet process or called to clarify parts of it or give testimonials about the powerfully positive effect that applying that tool in their life has had. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do that soon and often because it might raise questions or comments for them, and then they can call us. We have the current show is going 5 days a week, 2 hours a day. It is we have a call-in number of 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. We've also made the commitment to work through or step through the Course in Miracles workbook lessons, and today is the 90th day of the year. And so today, Lesson 90 is a review of two lessons, Lesson 79 and Lesson 80. Lesson 79 reads, let me recognize the problem so it can be solved. Let me realize today that the problem is always some form of grievance that I would cherish. Let me also understand that the solution is always a miracle with which I let the grievance be replaced. today I would remember the simplicity of salvation by reinforcing the lesson that there is one problem and one solution. The problem is a grievance, the solution is a miracle. And I invite the solution to come to me through my forgiveness or dismantling of the grievance and my welcoming of the miracle that takes its place. Specific applications of this idea might be, this current situation presents a problem to me which I would have resolved, which I would like to resolve, which I want to be resolved. The miracle behind this grievance will resolve it for me. The answer to this problem is the miracle that the grievance conceals. Lesson 80's review is, let me recognize my problems have been solved. I seem to have problems only because I am misusing time. I believe that the problem comes first and time must elapse before it can be worked out. I do not see the problem and the answer as simultaneous in their occurrence. That is because I do not yet realize that God has placed the answer together with the problem so that they cannot be separated by time. The Holy Spirit will teach me this if I will let him. And I will understand it is impossible that I could have a problem which has not already been solved. So these forms of this idea might be useful. I need not wait for this current situation to be resolved. The answer to this current problem is already given me if I will accept it. Time cannot separate this problem from its solution. We're also working through the Course in Miracles experiment book by Pam Grout, and her chapter 90 is titled, No Problemo. She quotes Adyashanti as saying, this idea that there is a problem, that's the wild hair in the ass of humanity. The need to know is it's impossible to have a problem that has not already been solved. She suggests the song Beautiful World by Colin Hay. And when you think everything's gone wrong, Pam writes, if you've been hanging out at the party disguised as this book, you already know my favorite practice in all the world is gratitude. I practice gratitude nonstop. I notice that when I don't, and when I start thinking something's wrong, that some person doesn't love me enough, or that I'm not worthy of this or that, my thoughts take a big dip toward darkness. In Lesson 90, the last in the review, it lays it all out. The only problem I can ever have is forgetting to be grateful. The Course calls that a grievance. As I become more aware of each tiny grievance, those subtle messages that still run very quietly in the background, and as I return to gratitude, I get closer to that truth I always talk about. The biggest secret in the world is we all really love each other. Last night, while dancing on the roof with my beautiful friends at a spiritual community in Mexico, I looked out over the stunning Lake Chapala landscape and realized I was so in love, so happy, so who I really am. And that's why I get up every morning. I make my intention for an extraordinarily epic day and continuously count my blessings. When I do that, grievances don't stand a chance. So that's Lesson 90. the review of lessons 79 and 80 and sets us up for the middle of the week where we finish the review lessons and move on to lesson 91 tomorrow. So, we have 49 minutes left. That's short readings today. Plenty of time for questions or comments. As I was preparing for the show today, I thought if no one raises a hand, I will read a little bit from Glennon Doyle's book, Untamed. And there's a section, a small section of the book that she titles Know, K-N-O-W. And she's listing some keys, and this is the second key. The second key is to know. Again, Glennon Doyle, the book Untamed, and she writes, several years ago, very early one morning, I found myself unable to sleep yet again. It was 3 a.m., and I was wild-eyed, shaky, flailing, grasping for answers like a drowning woman desperate for air. She says, I had just typed these words into my Google search window. What should I do if my husband is a cheater, but also an amazing dad? She says, I stared at that question and thought, well, I've hit some sort of a new rock bottom. I've just asked the internet to make the most important and personal decision of my life. Why do I trust everyone else on earth more than I trust myself? Where the hell is myself? When did I lose touch with her? I clicked on article after article anyway. Distressingly, everyone thought I should do something different. The religious experts insisted that a good Christian would stay. The feminists argued that a strong woman would leave. Parenting articles preached that a good mother thinks only of what is best for her children. All of those differing opinions meant that I quite likely, literally could not please everyone. And that was a relief. When a woman finally learns that pleasing the world is impossible, she becomes free to learn how to please herself. I looked at all those contradictory opinions and thought, if there is, in fact, an objective right or wrong way to handle this, why do all these people have such different ideas about what a person should do? I then had an epiphany. It must be that should and shouldn't, right and wrong, good and bad, well, they're not wild. They're not real. They're just culturally constructed, artificial, ever-changing cages created to maintain institutions. It struck me that in every family, culture, or religion, ideas of right and wrong are the hot cattle prods, the barking sheepdogs that keep the masses in the herd. They are the bars that keep us caged. I decided that if I kept doing the, quote, right thing, close quotes, I would spend my life following someone else's directions instead of my own. I didn't want to live my life without living my life. I wanted to make my own decision as a free woman, from my soul, not from my training. But the problem was, I didn't know how. A few weeks later, I opened a card from a friend that said in bold, capital, thick black lettering, "Be still and know." I'd read that verse many times before, but it struck me freshly this time. It didn't say, "Poll your friends and know," or "Read books by experts and know," or "Scour the internet and know." It suggested a different approach to knowing. Just stop. stop moving, stop talking, stop searching, stop panicking, stop flailing. Just stop doing, and you'll start knowing. This seemed like magical nonsense, but desperate women take desperate measures. I decided to experiment. After the kids left for school, I shut myself in a closet, sat down on a towel, closed my eyes, and did nothing but breathe. At first, each 10-minute session felt like 10 hours long. I checked my phone every few moments, planned my grocery lists, and mentally redecorated my living room. The only things I seemed to, quote, know, close quotes, on that floor were that I was hungry and itchy and suddenly desperate to fold laundry and reorganize my pantry. I was an input junkie thrown into detox. I was tempted to quit every second. But I was stern with myself. 10 minutes a day is not too long to spend finding yourself, Glennon. For God's sake, you spend 80 minutes a day finding your keys. After a few weeks, like a gymnast who is able to stretch deeper after each training, I began to feel myself dropping lower during each closet session. Eventually, I sank deep enough to find a new level inside me that I'd never known existed. This place is underneath, low, deep, quiet, still. There are no voices there, not even my own. All I can hear down there is my breath. It was as though I'd been drowning in my panic. I had been gasping for air, calling for rescue, and flailing on the surface. But what I really needed to do to save myself was let myself sink. It struck me that this is why we say to people, calm down. Because beneath the noise of the pounding, swirling surf is a place where all is quiet and clear. Since the chaos stills in this deep, I could sense something there I was not able to sense while on the surface. It was like the silent chamber in Denmark, one of the quietest places in the world, where people can actually hear and feel their own blood circulating. There, in the deep, I could sense something circulating inside of me. It was a knowing. I can know things down at this level that I can't know on the chaotic surface. Down here, when I pose a question about my life, in words or abstract images, I sense a nudge. The nudge guides me toward the next precise thing, and then when I silently acknowledge the nudge, it fills me. The knowing feels like warm liquid gold filling my veins and solidifying just enough to make me feel steady and certain. What I learned, even though I'm afraid to say it, is that God lives in this deepness inside of me. When I recognize God's presence and guidance, God celebrates by flooding me with warm liquid gold. Every day I returned to the closet, sat down on the floor littered with t-shirts and jeans, and practiced sinking. The knowing would meet me in the deep and nudge me toward the next right thing, one thing at a time. That was how I began to know what to do next. That was how I began to walk through my life more clearly, solidly, and steady. A year later, I found myself in the middle of a work meeting, sitting at a long conference table. We were discussing an important decision that had to be made, and the team was looking to me for leadership. I felt uncertain. I was about to fall back into my old way of knowing, looking outward for acceptance, permission, and consensus. But when I glanced over and caught sight of the door to the supply room closet, I remembered my new way of knowing. I wondered if the team would mind if I excused myself to spend a few minutes in that closet. Instead, I took a deep breath and with eyes wide open, I turned inward and tried to sink right there at the table. It worked. I sensed the nudge. And as soon as I acknowledged it, I was filled with the warm liquid gold. I rose back to the surface, smiled, and said, I know what to do. I calmly and assuredly told the others the thing I wanted us to do. The panic in the room settled. Everyone breathed and seemed instantly relaxed and steady. We moved on. God came out of the closet, and now I can take God anywhere. I now take orders only from my knowing, whether I'm presented with a work, personal, or family decision, whether it's monumental or tiny. Whenever uncertainty arises, I sink. I sink beneath the swirl and the surf of words, fear, expectations, conditioning, and advice, and I feel for the knowing. I sink 100 times a day. I have to, because the knowing never reveals a 5-year plan. It feels to me like a loving, playful guide, like the reason it will only reveal the next right thing to do is that it wants me to come back again and again, because it wants to do life together. After many years, I'm developing a relationship with this knowing, and we are learning to trust each other. When I talk like this, my wife raises her eyebrow and asks, "Aren't you just talking to yourself down there?" Well, maybe. If what I've found in the deep is just myself, if what I've learned is not how to commune with God, but how to commune with myself, if who I have learned to trust is not God, but myself, and if for the rest of my life, no matter how lost I get, I know exactly where to go and how to find myself again, well then, that's perfect. That is certainly enough of a miracle for me. Why do we worry about what to call the knowing instead of sharing with each other how to call the knowing? I know many people who have found this level inside of them, and they live solely by it. Some call the knowing God or wisdom or intuition or source or deepest self. I have a friend with some serious God issues, and she calls it Sebastian. A God by any other name is an equal miracle and a relief. It doesn't matter what we call our knowing. What matters, if we want to live our singular shooting star of a life, what matters is that we call it. I've learned that if I want to rise, I have to sink first. I have to search for and depend upon the voice of inner wisdom instead of the voices of outer approval. This saves me from living someone else's life. It also saves me a hell of a lot of time and energy. I just do the next thing the knowing guides me toward, one thing at a time. I don't ask permission first, which is just a grown-up way to live. The best part is this. The knowing is beyond and beneath language, so I have no language to use to translate it to anyone. Since it doesn't use words to explain itself to me, I quit using words to explain myself to the world. This is the most revolutionary thing a woman can do. The next precise thing, one thing at a time, without asking permission or offering explanation. This way of life is thrilling. I understand now that no one else in the world knows what I should do. The experts don't know, the ministers, the therapists, the magazines, the authors, my parents, my friends, they don't know. Not even the folks who love me the most. Because no one has ever lived or will ever live this life I'm attempting to live. With my gifts and challenges and past, and people. Every life is an unprecedented experiment. This life is mine alone. So I've stopped asking people for directions to places they've never been. There is no map. We are all pioneers. I have this second key tattooed on my wrist. Be still. It's my daily reminder that if I am willing to sit in the stillness with myself, I always know what to do. That the answers are never out there. They are as close as my breath and as steady as my heartbeat. All I have to do is stop flailing, sink below the surface, and feel for the nudge and the gold. Then I have to trust it, no matter how illogical or scary the next right thing seems, because the more consistently, bravely, and precisely I follow the inner knowing, the more precise and beautiful my outer life becomes. The more I live by my knowing, the more my life becomes my own, and the less afraid I become. I trust that the knowing will go with me wherever I go, nudging me toward the next thing, one thing at a time, guiding me all the way home. How to know. Momentary uncertainty arises. Breathe, turn inward, sink. Feel around for the knowing. Do the next thing it nudges you toward. Let it stand. Don't explain. Repeat this forever. For the rest of your life, continue to shorten the gap between the knowing and the doing. Glennon Doyle's book, Untamed, the section titled, Know, K-N-O-W. It is my assertion, my experience, that the core tool in Michael Rice's work is focused on this process. In every worksheet, the chattering mind is telling me, these are your thoughts, this is the person outside of you, this is what did or didn't happen, this is the emotion that's happening, this is what you need to fix it, this is what you have to get them to do. Chitter and chatter, clanging away, chaotically on the surface of my mind. And the process of the worksheet is to map that out, including what I think needs to happen, and then cancel it all and sink. Get quiet and ask to be shown. There's a knowing inside of me that will respond. And this reminds me of the Way of Mastery's fourth chapter, where it talks about, it uses the word desire, and there's this energy of desire, but it's a very subtle energy. It's so subtle that we need to practice awareness of it, tuning into it. And every one of us will find our own specific way to do that. I just happen to think that Glennon Doyle's segment on that was very well written and very, for me, very similar to the experience I have when I have a knowing. So our call number is 563-999-3581 or something like that. I'm too far away to see it from the computer screen. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. We had our Tuesday group last night, and we listened to the beginning of Lesson 6 from The Way of Mastery, The Way of the Heart, with J.M. reading the original, or doing the original channeling. We were tapping into the original audio. And I think I only let us listen to about a half an hour of it because it's just so packed with thoughts. And yet, it's very much this same process, understanding that we race around outside of ourselves looking for answers or looking for someone to say or do something so that we can feel good or feel loved. And the more we race around looking outside of ourselves for that, the less likely we are to have any good results, any satisfying results. And the reason for that is because we are, and we carry inside of us, that very energy of creation, of love, of connection that our culture has taught us to look to the outside to find. And it will never be found outside of us. That's the hard truth of it. My loving sense, my sense of being loved, my happiness will never be found outside of me. And so that's another reason that it came to me to read this section from Glennon Doyle's book titled No, because it's all about turning inside and understanding that the source that is beating your heart and digesting your food and keeping your breath moving, that energy, whatever you want to call it, source, God, light, love, whatever, it is what you're made of. It is in you. It's closer to you than your own breath. And looking for it or the effects of it outside of you is worse than useless. It's detrimental. So I will put out another call for people to let us know if you have someone you think we should interview, a book title. I just ran across Mission 22, which is from out in Oregon, and they have a not-for-profit to end soldier suicide. And they've got a full year-long program based in science and nutrition and technology skills for meditating, and they partner veterans with somebody to be their, like, a buddy system for the year to go through this program and build skills, not just talk nicely about things, but build skills for dismantling the effects of their post-traumatic stress and or relieving their depression and moving them further and further away from any place where suicide would seem like a viable option. So I have reached out to them, and I'm hoping that they will connect with me for somebody that could be interviewed. And if you have read of something like that or heard of something like that from somebody on any basic mental health issue or anything to benefit veterans or anything to do with trauma, depression, please let me know. Either call in 563-999-3581 or send me an email at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And when you do, I will follow through on that and see if we can't make a connection and further this project. So, comments and questions, answers, soliloquies. The second hour of our show today will not have the option for comments or questions. So, if you've got a comment or a question, please bring it up now. The second half of the show will be a replay because stuff is happening in Michael and Jeannie's world, and Jeannie won't be able to be available for a switchboard tour, and neither is Michelle, so we're going to replay an episode. So if you have a comment or a question and you want to bring up a topic, now is the time, 563-999-3581. And the title of the show we're going to play later is The Similarities with Alcoholics Anonymous. And she says it's an hour long. I don't know if she's got a combination of shows or she's just edited one of the past shows where that was one of the topics that came up quite commonly. It's for a while there in one of the years of this show, Michael called it Recovery Wednesdays. And so that'll be our second hour. So we've got 24 or 25 minutes left. How can we support you? What's on your mind? I'm scheduled to do an interview soon with Jeffrey Bruno, who's a PhD, and he's written a book titled Eat Light and Feel Bright, Microalgae Solutions for Individual and Planetary Health. He has a lot to say. This book, including all the references, is over 400 pages long, so 459 pages. So, hopefully we'll have some good stuff to share from that before too long. That interview is coming up in a couple weeks. So you can see, we're all over the map with potential topics for interviews. If anybody knows Glennon Doyle or how I can get a connection to her, I'd be happy to interview her. We've interviewed people who are integrative psychiatrists. We've interviewed people who are authors of books for young people. We've interviewed people who are into herbalism and people who are into yoga and people who have written books about mental health for law enforcement or emotional health for law enforcement. And so there's a very broad range of topics that would be useful. So if you have a thought about something that you've read, whether it was recent or distant past, or somebody that you think is really on target with the advice they're giving for self-help, emotional health, mental health, etc., I would greatly appreciate that suggestion. And again, you can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And if you're interested and you don't want to get involved in this, you can look into mission22.com. And that is if you know somebody who's a veteran who's struggling. This is not a crisis hotline. This is a long-term program for veterans, for their families, and it's, you know, purported to be science-based solutions for helping people resolve their depression and their trauma and their anxiety and build the skills to live a healthier, happier life even after returning from traumatic experience as a veteran. So this is our offering. Go inside, and every worksheet I ask myself or I ask someone or something more complex and integrated than my conscious logical mind or my normal intellectual capacity to show me something that's relevant about my current situation. Whenever I have a negative emotional state, I can know instantly that this is what I'm experiencing in this moment is not about what's happening in my life in the moment. What I'm experiencing in the moment is an old tape playing. And if I buy into that old tape playing and or take an action based on that negative emotion from that old tape playing, I am only, always and forever going to make my current situation worse. I can't throw negative emotional energy into my life situation in any moment and expect it to get better. So we are advocating the frequent and active use of the Reality Management Worksheet, and we are hopeful that you will find it a useful tool as we do. Today's Wednesday. So tomorrow we have another support group happening. We would be thrilled if you decide to join us, or if you know someone that would benefit and you pass the information along to them. And in any way possible, either use the tools that you have found in this work with Michael and Jeannie, or tools you've found somewhere else, to improve your life, improve the quality of your life. Why? Because it is, you know, as Glennon Doyle was talking about in the book I was just reading, it is a one-shot deal. Nobody else has your life. Nobody else is capable of knowing what you should do and how you should do it and when you should do it. No one else has ever lived your life the way you're living it. And so looking to other people as an outside expert for what you should do in your life is, it's worse than counterproductive. So I had some things flooding my brain this morning about how important it is for us to learn to develop this kind of a knowing that Glennon Doyle is talking about, so that we do not rely on people and things outside of us, outside experts, religious figures, etc. Because, as she says so clearly, no one outside of you can know what is best for you to do in this moment. It is somewhat, I'll say, bizarre that we live in a culture where that is not common knowledge, that we're living in a culture where the primary thing we're taught from the beginning of our lives is look to people outside of us as the source for our pain, and look to people outside of us for the solution to our pain or discomfort. And the core of this work, the reason we've donated all of this time and dedicated so much time to these tools, is because the truth is opposite. The truth is the source of my pain is internal and the solution to my pain is internal. So the more I practice the use of the tools, the more I train myself to, as Glennon Doyle would say, sink, to get quiet and to understand that the truth is the answers to my discomfort are inside me. Just as the lesson for today says, as soon as I identify a problem, its answer is contained in that very situation. And the truth of it is that it's only the way I have identified or interpreted the situation that's formulated it into a grievance that creates the problem. And that grievance in that very moment is the thing that blocks me from seeing the miracle behind the grievance. And I really get it, especially when people talk about how could that be, you know, what about this terrible tragedy that's happening in the world, and what about, you know, the physical illness? We had somebody in our group last night who's got a family member that is having serious physical problems, and one of our group members said, yeah, but you know, as we're talking about this, it's all in different levels of scale. Yeah, and the level of scale we're talking about when we're reading A Course in Miracles or The Way of Mastery or the level of scale we're talking about when you're reading a Pam Grout book is the highest level of scale you can get contact with your inner knowing. It's not the level of scale that your eyes would show you of the outside world, the physical realm. And, you know, comes to mind as I talk about this various times, there's a movie, I think it's called, I forget the name of the movie, but Nicolas Cage is in it, and he plays an angel who falls in love with a surgeon, and the surgeon is, you know, top-notch and doing the best she can, and but her patient dies anyway. And she just keeps saying, that wasn't supposed to happen. I did everything right. That wasn't supposed to happen. And Nicolas Cage, as the angel, breaks all the rules and comes to her in physical form and says, there's more going on here than you know about. And that would be a way to talk about things in scale. So at one level of scale, I'm here, and it seems like I'm one person, a physical body, separated from the desk and the people across the way in an office and the people down the street in an office. And that's what my senses will show me. My senses will show me countless bits of evidence that I'm separate and that I don't have a connection to other people. But at another level of scale, and with practice, another level of experience I can usher myself into, I can get a sense of the connectedness of all things. Michael Rice was talking about this when he was talking, I think it was Monday, he was talking about all the work he and Jeannie had done over the weekend and breathing and he talked about how years ago he had had an opening, an experience, kind of a God moment. And how long it lasted for several days at least. But it wasn't anything he could have words for. It wasn't anything that his conscious, logical mind could comprehend. And yet, it was as real, if not more real, than anything else he has words for. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about using the tools so that we can experience ourselves differently than just our senses would usher us into. Someone in the chat room has just said that her sound has gone off twice and she's had to go out and come back on. Has anybody else had this? So Susan, just put your hand up.
Hi. No,
have you been experiencing sound break?
No, it's been fine from on my phone.
All right, wonderful. Well, hello. What are your thoughts?
Hi. Oh, I loved that reading, Glennon Doyle. I loved the Pam Grout, too. The juxtaposition and opposition of gratitude versus grievance. I told my daughter about that this morning on a call, and she said, oh, yeah, you know, that for her wasn't a revelation. For me, it was a revelation that if I'm having any kind of upset, I'm not in gratitude. And that is just such a handy thing to think about and use. But I do have a specific question, and you got close to it when you were just talking now. I have a former client who started out as a friend, and I stopped working with her and her partner, her sometimes partner, sometimes not partner, because they just couldn't or wouldn't use the tools and found them just not right for them. And my way of thinking and my use of the Course in Miracles, all of the stuff I had wasn't useful to them. And so a long period passed, and she texted me the other day, and she said, I haven't talked to you in ages. And I thought, well, maybe we've gone back to being friends. I'll give her a call, and I did. And she said, oh, I'm so glad to hear from you. And she said, my partner and I have the same issues going. We found another therapist, and sometimes we attend as couples and sometimes by myself. And the issues had not gotten better. And she also talked about some health problems, which I had known about, which were much worse, lung problems, asthma. They both had COVID, and she has after experiences COVID. And I was listening to this and just what Michael calls holding the space, tempted to want to say, well, are you ready for the tools? I didn't say much. I just listened. But I'm telling you, I have to do work on this for myself because the pressure inside me built up to offer something, to help, to fix. And the way she was talking, it was almost as if she was hoping I would launch into my therapist persona. But I didn't. I just listened and I said, oh, my God, that sounds very hard. And I imagine you're going to, you know, you'll find your way. I tried to build her up. You know, you're so bright. it'll come to you. I didn't even want to say you'll figure it out, which is her favorite phrase. Well, we'll figure it out. And I just stayed on the phone and listened. For me, it was a very unsatisfying conversation. And I felt as if I hadn't done anything but listen well, breathe, but withhold everything I know to be helpful, any kind of tool or anything. I just listened, and that was it. And then she got off. But the friendship, I don't think it will last because there was nothing much to go on as far as I can see. And I haven't heard back from her or, you know, she seemed very down, very muted, low energy. And that's how it stayed. So I wondered if you could, with all that you've said and read today, the invitation is go inside myself, see what the upset is, do the worksheets on that, trust my own intuition for myself to know the truth for myself. But here I'm sitting with this event, and I know time is getting very short. So,
what's the emotion you're left sitting with?
Well, it's a feeling of a tight chest, sadness for them, that they seem to be more mired in the problems they brought to sessions with me.
Okay, so the primary thing right there would be to do the worksheets on the sadness.
Okay.
Somehow assuming that what their choice of how to live their life is worse than yours. You know, the thing that comes to mind as I heard you talking was the Guy Finley has a talk where he says, you know, we're amazing in our capacity to be in denial. We can be crying, slobbering in our own juices on the bathroom floor, despondent, upset, our life is a wreck. And the phone rings, and it's one of our friends, and we are instantly the expert in what they need to do to fix it.
Okay. Yep.
And so the first thing I would encourage you to do is worksheets to dismantle your sadness, because here you are in emotional pain, sadness, and thinking that you've got something that would help them with their emotional pain, but you can't fix your own, or you haven't yet. you know, dismantled your own. So that would be where I would start. Start with your own worksheets to dismantle your sadness. And then, if you want to use the process that Glennon Doyle outlines, where you get quiet and just sink and wait for the nudging, maybe you'll get nudged to just leave it alone. Maybe you'll get nudged to reach out to her. But, you know, your infinitely wise inner wisdom will have a better answer for you than anything I could come up with.
That's great. Yeah, and there were other feelings too. I wanted to say, well, no, it wasn't sadness. I wanted to get off that hot seat because you took it away and I could say something else, but it's the same thing. Frustration, a feeling of being unfulfilled, as if we didn't connect. That's all my stuff. Yeah.
So the best answer I would have for you would be doing the worksheet process on whatever you would label it in the moment, whatever the emotion or thought would be in the moment.
Yeah.
And trusting that that's going to, you know, produce more benefits than any preaching to somebody else. And it's only after I get into that calm, centered space and get connected to my awareness of my perfect safety and my miracle of life expressing through me that there's even a chance for something more healing to come out of me. But when I'm coming from my stuff, there's no chance.
Boy, that's big, because I was thinking all along, I'm withholding my best stuff from them. What am I doing? Well, it's like being in love and having it be unrequited. Something wasn't happening. I had tons of goals for them. Couldn't just listen. Let them be. Oh, yeah. Just let them do what they're doing and be what they're being and relish the fact that we're in touch or not. I mean, it could be anything, but you've helped me realize all over again that this sore left arm that tries to hold on to other people's stuff and doesn't let people do their journey, in my mind, they're going to do their journey anyway, starts to rear up again. It's like a trigger response, total trigger response. Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, what I do for myself when that kind of thing happens is I ask myself, either through the worksheet process or the simple asking to be shown, what is this in me I'm running from? You know, focusing on anybody else in one way or another essentially means I'm running from something of my own.
Right.
And so I just ask, okay, what are you running from? And then when the issues start to present themselves, I use the tools.
Okay. It gets quicker and quicker for you to go to the jugular and put your finger right on it, Dr. Tim.
Well, I don't know about... I don't know about you, but it didn't feel like I was trying to kill you with anything I said, but going for the jugular is a rather vivid terminology there. Here's hoping it didn't actually feel like an assault, but...
No, it didn't at all. It's like being brought around. It's like being a horse that forgot that he'd been brought inside the corral. He was out again, you know, and you slung your rodeo rope and got me by the neck and brought me back into the corral.
Well, there's something about the neck and the jugular up here for you, so somehow or another it doesn't feel very loving, whatever our exchange was, so I would be happy to help you sort through
God.
That.
Free up that
energy around your neck, please.
My
it,
mom's
it's okay.
favorite phrase is, you are being a pain in the neck.
Okay.
There you go.
All right.
Well,
so anyway. We are at the end of our time. And did you have a last comment you wanted to make?
No. Yes. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. I deeply appreciate your calls and comments. Yeah. It always makes it easier to get through the show when there's some input and feedback. And I'll mute you and get ready for the translation or transition to the other second hour. We're going to be listening to a show titled Similarities to AA Programs. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. We'll be back again tomorrow. Blessings.
We've been doing all this week with Gail and looking at abuse programs such as Alcoholics Anonymous and the correlation with that and the forgiveness work, and she's with us again today. We're excited to continue with this conversation. And we would love to hear your comments and your questions because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. We're honored that you're here to join us for our conversation about this awesome ancient technology of healing. One of the things I appreciated that Gail shared with us on Monday is that the root of the 12th step program initially came out of a thing called the Oxford Group, which was a group practicing what was understood then to be first century Christianity, not today's, stories that passes the original teachings, but actually going back more to the first century and what was actually, for those who heard the words of Yeshua, had the tools of Yeshua, what it took to work through the issues that tend to run people's lives. And, you know, one of the things we return to often is the recognition that perception, which is what informs us to do certain behaviors, is all based in calculations and computations made by the mind. We've been taught that we're looking through a set of windows on the world and we see what's happening out there. And that teaching is an absolute, total, complete, 100% proven scientific fraud. It's just not true. Once you recognize that, then you realize that your mind is always computing based on its content and constructing the world that you see. In fact, there's a CIA website where they have a study of perception. And quote from the CIA and their research on perception, we do not record what is happening in the world. We construct the world that we see. So recognizing that we construct the world that we see, then you realize that the world you see, that you live in, though we think through our windows we're looking at the same thing, it's not true. We can be standing, ostensibly looking at the same world, but the computation your mind makes based on your 1,000 generations of data produces a totally different perceptual world than that which my mind computes based on 1,000 generations of data. Recognizing that, the idea is to bring the perceptual system into the greatest harmony it can have with truth. And what we're speaking of, what we've been talking about all week, is the anonymous systems that have developed over the years to assist people in changing the computations made out of each individual's, we could say, multi-generational database, that 1,000 generations of data. What we know is that if fear or hostility enter into the process, it's been signaled that your computation is incorrect and will not serve your highest and best possibilities. It's a signal that it's time to deconstruct the result of your computations. And deconstructing the result of a perceptual computation made by your mind is called forgiveness. What the Greek culture has taught us is that forgiveness is about letting ourselves or somebody else off the hook for something that we have or have not done. When that has nothing whatsoever to do with forgiveness, forgiveness is a tool for removing that which is in your mind that is at the root of your pain, for accessing and relieving yourself of the root of that pain. So the deconstruction process, the removal process, is called forgiveness. And as you enter into the process of forgiveness, you become freed from literally the capacity for hostility or fear. There are many systems that have been developed over the eons for teaching people to do that. One that has proven very powerful for those in the most dire of circumstances are the 12-step programs. And again, the root of that goes back to the first century language of Yeshua and the work that we're doing. And I was so delighted when I heard that from you, Gail, the root of the 12-step program. That's not something that I had heard before, because it's right back to here's how the game of life works, and here's how to remove yourself from pain, how to release yourself from what's at the root of all pain. And when you do that, you correct the error at the root of the mind's output, so the output improves, and that increases the possibility that the end result, perception, will serve your highest and best as a human being. All realities, all perception is based on generations of such computations. And so recognizing that, the possibility for the introduction of error is endless. There's an infallible signal that will tell you your perception. Therefore, your mind is in error and needs repair, and that is if it produces hostility or fear. So it's in our best interest to deconstruct, that is, forgive, as often as necessary until we arrive at flawless perception, a perception that sparkles with the active presence of love continuously, no matter what's happening in your world. People will say, well, that made me sad, that made me mad, that made me angry, that hurt me. That's all a lie. If I have hurt in my system, now, somebody comes up and punches me in the nose, cancel the thought, that's a little different situation. But short of somebody coming up and punching you in the nose, all hurt, all pain, all trauma is something that comes from that multi-generational database and its activity. When you correct the perceptual system, there's a word, rachma, in Aramaic. That was the word that was used to describe what was required to achieve what was called the first law. And it was have not love for the God, neighbor, and as self, but rather maintain this condition of love in your mind, this condition of rachma in your mind, so that your perception sparkles with the presence of love, even in events that someone would say are very painful events. Once you get to the point where you can do that, then you know you are well along in your process of healing. We mentioned Jonas Salk yesterday, and one of the quotes that I love from Jonas Salk is, he said, and of course he's the inventor of the Salk vaccine, he says, our greatest responsibility is to be good ancestors. How do you be a good ancestor? You do the work of cleaning up your perceptual system so that the one that you pass on to the next generation is clean, it's clear, it's going to give that next generation the best possible chance of really, truly living as a human life. And when you think about it, you know, who makes the great breakthroughs in this world of human endeavor? It's those whose computations that create reality, the output of the mind, are based in truth and love. The rest are mired in insanity, loveless minds based in hostility or fear, and healing looks like the removal, the forgiveness of what never belonged. So that's what we're here to support. And let's say hello to Gail. We appreciate you being here. We appreciate the input you're giving to us. I was talking to another gentleman who has been doing the work for quite some time now, and shared with him what was happening. And he wasn't able to be in the involved in the shows earlier in the week. He was involved in some meetings. But last night about 11:30, he having been in AA programs for 20 years or more, he texted me and said he was listening to the second hour and he just was in love with what was happening in the show. So lots of folks are really responding to that. And welcome. Glad that you're here once again.
Great. Well, I am very grateful to be a part of all of this and to be invited to contribute the pieces of the puzzle that I have to offer. So that's awesome. Awesome.
Honored.
Yeah, same here. And that was a great lead. That's what we call, like, when somebody speaks for the first, 10, 15 minutes in a meeting, we call those a lead. So that was a great lead, which ties in perfectly with what I was going to bring today. And that was to start looking at what the inventory process and 12-step programs look like versus what it looks like on the sheet. And we've all agreed so far that the sheet, the wake-up sheet, is an inventory in itself. But there is also an inventory within the inventory on the wake-up sheet that is similar to what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to point
Great.
Out
Tell us about
also...
It.
Oh, what did you say? I'm sorry.
I was just saying, great, tell us about it.
Okay, gotcha. One of the things that I do want to point out is that the way I was taught to do the inventory process comes out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Other 12-step groups have different ways of doing their inventory, and I want to acknowledge that as well. How I've been taught how to do the inventory process is that it's a 14-step or 14-column process, and what is addressed in the inventory process is resentments, fear, sex conduct, and harms done to others. And so there's four sheets with that. And also there's a written exercise for the sex inventory part. And I was just going to start with the resentment part. There's four columns that we do, and we do it by column. We go down instead of going across. And in the first column, we write down the name of the people that we have resentments against. And so we write down that list, and we do a lot of prayer before that, ask God or to reveal to us who we need to write down, what we need to look at. In the second column, we write down why we're angry at them. So what I usually have people do is I have them write down a list on a separate piece of paper, and then when we get to the sheets, have them write down the name and then what they did so they have enough room, and then write down the next name after they're done with writing down what they did. And then the next column, what we look at is what part of self was threatened. And there's seven different parts of self. And that is self-esteem, which is what we think of ourselves, pride, and that's what we think other people think about us, emotional security, pocketbook, which would be our finances or material, ambitions, and that would be our ambitions or where we think we should be in different societies or family systems or in school or at our job, personal relations, and sex relations. And the thinking here is that if we are God-centered, or as we say in the Aramaic system, if we're able to express ourselves as being love, then what other people do outside of us does not affect. And so the premise here, too, is that if we're God-centered, we're not going to be affected by what other people do. But if we're self-centered, we need to examine how we've allowed ourselves to be affected by examining those seven things. And then in the fourth column, we start to turn this back on ourselves and to examine what our thinking is and to start to examine how we might have set different sets of situations in motion. So we're starting to go inside instead of projecting out there what they did to me, or and how I've been affected by what they did, It's now we ask ourselves five questions, and then we start to write about how we set this in motion. And the five questions are, where was I dishonest, selfish, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate? And that tells me here, goals, you know, what goals did I have for you? And then after we ask those questions about different situations, then we're able to look at ourselves and to see where we were at fault or to blame or to start to take responsibility for our own thinking and how we put ourselves or manifested that situation. And I'm going to give an example of what this might look like. And I do the same thing that you do as well, how you have the same example for Sally and how she's angry at her boss. I have the same example as well. And I was thrilled that you do that because when I'm teaching or demonstrating how to work the steps, I use the same example as well. So anyway, the example that I use every single time that I present this piece is, of course, the father of my children, my ex, so to speak. I'm not supposed to call him the ex anymore, but his name is Kyle, and so I put his name in the first thing. What he did, he cheated on me. He was very abusive. He never got sober in our relationship, and the list goes on. What did he affect? He affected everything. He affected self-esteem, pride, emotional security, pocketbook, ambitions, personal relations, and sex relations for sure. And then when I started to turn this back on me, where was I dishonest, selfish, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate? I could say I was dishonest with him because I wasn't able to be me with him. And so that was one way of being dishonest with him. The way that I was selfish with him is that I did not acknowledge his disease as being a disease. I was selfish because I wanted his 100% attention. And if he couldn't give it to me the way that I wanted it, then I would cheat on him. I would seek that attention someplace else. So that was how I was selfish, is in that way. Self-seeking is still wanting all of his attention. I was very addicted to the father of my children and was very much addicted to the attention that he gave me when he gave it to me in a certain way. And so I was constantly seeking that or trying to get that from him because I wasn't comfortable or had pain that I was trying to reconcile through our relationship and being addicted to him. Frightened, I was constantly frightened in that relationship, but the primary fear that I entered that relationship in was I didn't feel like I could be me. I felt like I had to be somebody else. So he was in a relationship with the false me, you know, with the real Gail, please stand up. And I was frightened in all relationships to be the real authentic self because of fear of rejection. What if you really do reject the real me? And then inconsiderate, I was totally and completely inconsiderate of his needs. And the primary thing for me is that I wanted to save him, and thinking that if I saved him, that he would save me. So
saving him meant
he would be so much in love with me that he would not leave.
And what would saving him look like, having him behave the way you wanted him to behave?
Exactly. He would get clean. He would get sober. He would be this perfect guy. And, yeah, exactly. So it was my agenda on saving him.
Yeah, of course, the perfect guy would be the guy who does what I want him to do, not necessarily anything to do with him, because in the same way you're talking about I wasn't allowed to be me, notice that I could not allow him to be him. He had to be the perfect guy. And I think that happens so commonly in relationship. as a result of our power person experience, that at a very early age, we learn that who we are is not acceptable. And therefore, we try to do an assessment in each situation of who does this person need for me to be in order to, quote, unquote, love me, which actually means approve of me. And the lengths that people will go to be approved of are just amazing. And so we give up the true self. And then, of course, having given up the true self long before we met the person we're currently in relationship with, in the non-being state of mind, there's always a desire to blame that person for the fact that I'm still doing what I learned to do probably by the time I was four. And when we speak about, you know, somebody hurting us or making us angry or whatever, you know, nobody's ever made hurt any, again, short of punching somebody in the nose, nobody's ever hurt anybody or made anybody angry. But if there's anger in there, certainly there's going to be a whole parade of people who can bring it up. And when I move out
Absolutely.
Of the blame game and into taking responsibility, that's when I can start to go, oh, this is mine. I'm going to pull this one out and throw it away from by the root rather than let them off the hook for the fact that it's in there inside of me.
And the fact that we list everybody's names that we have, I most definitely, when I did my first inventory, I was able to see with the aid of a sponsor when I did my fist up, was able to see the pattern. And was able to trace that back to my father. Definitely the need to having been abandoned by my father at the age of five with a divorce and him being a Vietnam vet and being able to get his needs met through my mother, what he thought he needed to have his needs met, and being told that your father wouldn't have left if you were a boy, et cetera, et cetera. I did get to the place where I felt like I needed to save both of my parents in order to change them so they would be better parents and meet my needs. So that is most definitely a cycle of behavior that I was able to look at by doing this inventory and also doing the fist up and talking to a sponsor who was able to identify the cycle or the pattern as well. So just to give an example of... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's interesting how deeply we can fool ourselves and why it's so important to have a sponsor or have someone who will guide us through the process, because the inherent nature of what we call in this work, of course, the non-being mind is blockage of truth. And everybody's got a story for everything that happens in the world, and their story is usually about somebody else or about themselves. And not in a responsible way, but rather in a blaming way. And so having someone outside of yourself who can flip back to you your words, your thoughts, your behaviors, your patterns is such a big and important step in the process, because that blockage of truth is just so deeply ingrained in each mind. And to move out of, you know, as we said yesterday, the Oxford group and worked with the book of James, and James so clearly says, you've got to stop your denial. I mean, there's the root of the whole recovery program is stop your denial. There's the root of the forgiveness process. As long as I'm, and our definition of denial is when I think or speak as though something outside of me is causing something to happen inside of me, I'm in denial. And the part of me that now I need to contact and heal, I've dissociated from. And all this work is about recapturing the dissociated parts of the mind and bring them to love for healing.
Agreed. Agreed,
cool.
Agreed.
Go for it.
The next part of the inventory process is looking at our fears. And we write down our fears in one column. And then in the second column, we write down the same thing. How has self-reliance instead of God-reliance allowed me to have these areas of my life affected? And same thing, looking at self-esteem, pride, emotional security, pocketbook, ambitions, personal relations, and sex relations. And then the third column, with the fear, is to examine what it might have looked like if I would have been more God-centered And for instance, one of my fears that I wrote down is, is going to the store. I don't like going to the store. And the big part of me going to the store is being in crowds and not being able to concentrate, the attention deficit disorder, just having so many different stimuli and distractions that I have a difficult time concentrating on what I need to buy and how much I can spend, and so I don't like going. And so I write that down, going to the store, what does it affect, and then I examine if instead of using my survival skills in order to go to the store, if I become more God-centered and start to rely on God to go to the store, what would that look like? And to start to really address the fear, look at it instead of reacting to it. So that is the purpose of Killer Sheet, or that particular area of the inventory that we look at. We also look at the inventory, we also look at fear in the resentment part too, you know, where it asks, where were we frightened? And when I did my first inventory, I saw fear all over every single name that I wrote down. There was fear involved in every single place. It also talks about, in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about fear being an all-encompassing thread that I'm not even quoting it right, but it reaches every part of our existence. It touches everything. And I was able to finally, me as an alcoholic that would be willing to jump on a bar stool and start dancing or get into the first fight I could get into, I did not think that I didn't think that I had any fear. And this was very enlightening. The second inventory I did with a sponsor at 2 years of sobriety, I think approaching three, very much pointed out my fear. And one of my biggest fears besides going to the store was fear of being alone. And that fear of being alone and not being able to face myself or be comfortable enough to be alone with myself, always needing that distraction, was very enlightening for me, and that enabled me to get out of that 16-year extremely abusive revolving door relationship that I was in, because my fear of being alone outweighed my fear of getting beat up or what other things were going on in that relationship.
That's quite a catch-22. I have a fear of being with people, and I have a fear of being alone. Maybe the truth is I don't have a fear of anything. I just have fear. That's why it's all pervasive, because the fear literally is the filter that we look through. It isn't something we have about this person or that one or that one. It's just a filter that we look through. And I think oftentimes the reason for what's called attention deficit disorder has nothing to do with the disorder, has nothing to do with an error in the brain. It has to do with one who came up in such a threatening environment that in order to feel the least bit safe, they had to be continuously on guard and observing the environment because they didn't know when they were going to be blindsided. And
exactly.
So when one comes to the point of trust, when one will move into trust, that there is an energy field in which we live, move, and have our being, and we can listen to that and trust, then we're going to be informed if there's something to be aware of, and we're going to be informed as to exactly what behavior will have us survive optimally if we can listen to that, rather than the mind, which is constantly looking, darting from place to place to place in order to try to assuage its fear, going to the root of the fear and removing it and no longer looking through that filter opens a whole different space in us. So, but powerful way to approach it, to come from that inventory. I'd never heard that detailed an aspect of the inventory. That's powerful.
That's why I wanted to, that's why I wanted to present it, because a lot of people have a lot of misnomers, and you've said that yourself, of AA, of the steps, of the AA history, where it comes from, And also there's a lot of misconceptions about the inventory process as well. The next thing that we look at is sex conduct. And because you take self-centered fear and you combine sex conduct with that, and that is most definitely a recipe for disaster. For me, this is the worst way that I could hurt somebody else and hurt myself as well. And once again, we write down, and this takes a little bit different of a turn. This isn't so much about what they did to me in a relationship or a sexual context. This is what I did to them. And so we write down who did we hurt, and then and what we did to them. And a lot of the questions for here is, did we provoke jealousy? Did we remain faithful? And so the next thing is that we'd write down is, you know, whom did we hurt? How did we hurt them? And then what did it affect again? What part of self? Why were we justifying doing what we did in this arena? And once again, the same questions of what was affected as self-esteem, pride, you know, emotional security, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex relations. And then I'm going to back up for a second. Every step has a prayer and a promise. And what I mean by that is that there's a prayer to proceed, and there's also promises that after we do this, that this is what we're going to receive after we do this. And there is a third step prayer that we do, and there are also four step prayers. There is the resentment prayer, which asks us to keep us from being angry, help us to see that the other person is sick as well. There's a fear prayer that asks God to remove our fear so we can be who you need us to be. And there's three sex prayers. And prayers is that we ask God to mold our ideals and to help us live up to them. We ask God in meditation what we should do in each specific matter. And we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and for the strength to do the right thing. And so we examine in the sex part of the inventory. We look at what we did to them and look inside of us and I start to see a pattern of, if I couldn't get the kind of attention the way that I wanted the attention, then I would move on to the next person. And thinking that, you know, even though it was the next person, it's obviously a change in effects. It's not looking at myself and my thinking and addressing my beliefs and what's inside of me. It's just trying to get a void filled by somebody else or a chemical. So that was very enlightening as well, to see that pattern in all my relationships, starting from my very first crush in the third grade and my expectations of him and how I behaved, and up on to adulthood, looking at those behaviors and those expectations and those goals that I had for them.
I think that a good corollary to that, that comes from this work on our healing through relationships and codependence work, is to recognize that the real purpose of relationship, the real purpose of the body, is to incarnate as love. And the real purpose of relationship is to learn to function as love and hold a space of love in interaction with another person. And that moving on to the next person pretends to be easy in terms of, oh, well, if this one isn't, you know, just doing what I want them to do and they're not perfect, which, of course, is a reflection of my own imperfection, I go on and find somebody else who will be perfect, and, of course, they won't be, and the next one won't, and the next one won't, because I'm not. And the power of really being in fully committed relationship is that you have to go to depth in yourself. and be looking at, and if you're doing your work in the context of the relationship, then the integrity of that single committed relationship that supports you in going to depth inside of yourself and working with the reflections that come within the context of relationship, the things that surface in the context of relationship, and the depth of intimacy that comes from not flitting the mind from one place to another, one relationship to another, to another, to another, which is simply the avoidance of going to depth in self. So it's, again, sounds like it really perfectly complements exactly what we've developed in the codependence work. Perfect.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and agreed. The next part for the sex conduct, or the looking at our sex conduct, is that we write a list on a separate piece of paper about what we want. You know, we ask God to mold our ideals and to live up with them, to them. And so we write down our ideals about what we want in a relationship. And if we write down honesty, I was kind of tricked into this. My first sponsor had me do this. And I write all these things down that I want. And, you know, I want honesty. I want loyalty. I want somebody that is trustworthy. I want somebody that I can laugh and have fun with. And want somebody that works the steps and is in the program and is committed to their recovery. And as soon as I wrote those all down and shared them with her, she's like, well, you have to be these too. It's like, damn. And
exactly.
It was like, if you want this, you have to be this. You have to do this as well.
Well, and the truth is, is that bringing something up for you?
Yeah, I'm coughing.
The truth is, the only place you can get it is inside yourself. Nobody else can give
Absolutely.
It to you. Someone else can support you in having it inside yourself. And as you give it as a gift, you get to receive it. And as they give it as a gift, they get to receive it. And that's the power of working in a relationship. It's so awesome.
Yeah, it is. I loved it. At first it was like, and then I was like, okay, you know, I get this. So if I want it, I need to do it.
Great.
And this was an exercise that I brought forth when I was a substance abuse counselor in the prison. I did this with the guys as well. And it was great. It was great. For them to start to examine that for themselves. The last part that we do in the inventory process is that we look at harms done to others. And this is people or places or things that we don't have a resentment attached to, we don't necessarily have a fear attached to, and we don't have sexual contact, none of that. It's just random acts of harm that we might have just done either in an inebriated state or in a very selfish state of mind. That would be like, you know, bitching out the Walmart checker because she just wasn't going fast enough, and or running down somebody that's trying to cross the street, or just being very, you know, flipping off somebody at a four-way stop, or just that kind of, you know, being inconsiderate and being extremely selfish and it being all about me and acting out to those people, because guilt, shame, and remorse also blocks us off from God. So being able to list those people that we have harmed, that we don't have the other things attached to, is helpful as well. And
another way to say that, from the context of the why is this happening to me again work, would be I need to start to look at all the places in my life where I have given up my human life in mm-hmm. order to behave in a way other than human. And
Absolutely. That
becomes the reflection that shows me in order to flip somebody off of the four-way, I had to give up love in myself. Why would I do that to myself? Well, you know, I don't deserve it. I don't have it. I've never had it. I can never be it. You know, whatever that whole story is about. And then once again, of course, back to the forgiveness process, the reality management wake-up sheet, to start to remove the dynamics that take me out of the presence of love. So that inventory, too, is another very powerful reflection.
Agreed. So we'll go on to step five. Step five is we admitted to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Wait, did I say that all? We admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. And what I see in the wake-up sheet, the forming of the goal for me and the canceling of the goal for me would be similar for me in the fourth column of the fourth step, starting to examine the goals that I have for other people and starting to canceling those goals for other people. I see as that being the interwoven part of the fourth step. And the fourth step being, I don't think I've said it out loud, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And that means by looking up all the words is that we are on a fact-finding and fact-facing proposition or mission. We're just looking at the facts of our behavior and our thinking. And so to get down to the fifth step is they talk about in the big book, basically just go find anybody to talk about this with. Now they're saying it's better to do it with a sponsor so a sponsor could get to know you. And it is most definitely a skill set to listen to a fifth step. Instead of allowing somebody to get into the what they did to me, it's a time to get the mirror out and have them look in the mirror. And I was thrilled with your talk about mirrors as well, you know, the timing of being John the Baptist to either put the mirror up there or to duck. We use mirrors as well, and the sponsor is a perfect person if they have the skill set to get that mirror up there and to gently point out our character defects and how we've set our circumstances in motion that have put us in the position that we've put ourselves in to be hurt. And there's three parts to that, talking to God, talking to ourselves, admitting to God, admitting to ourselves and to another human being. I see the admittance to God and admittance to self in this, I invite in Rukita Kucha, 10 Climb Me Towards Healing, and what happens in 5B to be a part of that fifth step, because it's most definitely, we're inviting in Ruka to show us these things or admitting to her to have them removed, but also we're talking to ourselves as well. And then in the, when I process with you or I process with Jeannie or if I'm at an intensive and we're in the back room, me and Susan are in the back room processing, that's when we talk to another human being about what we've discovered in doing the wake-up sheet. So those are my thoughts there.
Perfect. I think that also one of the reasons for having, and I would assume this probably would tie in more with the idea of a sponsor, of the person you're going to share this with is someone who is capable of being the space of active present love, can shine that
Absolutely.
Active presence of love into the mind so that I can see deeper in my mind and what I access in the presence of that love begins to heal. I don't need to be sharing my deepest, bearing my deepest soul secrets to somebody who's going to go puke it around the neighborhood and or
Absolutely.
Is going to throw it back in my face in a way that that doesn't support healing. So that's powerful. And I just realized that I got a text from Jeannie saying that Magda had her hand up. Let's check and see if Magda
okay,
still has
really.
Her hand up. She's got a thought for us. Yes. Magda?
Magda, you're on.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
Hey there, young lady.
I do have a question for you. Yesterday you were talking a little bit about responsibility communication, and I know you said you're going to go into that a little bit more on Monday. However, I have a question for you today because I'm going to be working with Scott in a little while doing some role-playing with responsibility communication. And I realize that I need more clarification for step number four, if you would be willing to depart from the conversation you're having now and explain that quickly, and then I'll get off the line and let you go back to what you're doing.
Do you have a specific refinement, specific question about it, Magda?
Yeah. I thought that I've heard you recently say, when you've explained this to new people, that in number four, when you say what I want, that in some way that could be a request, like what I want from you, other than support, is to do this or that or that. And
no.
That not being problem solving, I don't, not about I need you to change this way, but I'm a little bit more confused than I thought I was before.
Okay. Excuse what? The siren going by. I'm sitting outside the car. But the step four there, the request is always related to the support I'm looking for, the input I'm looking for healing. So it's not a request I'm going to make of you that you do something or don't do something. It would always be, you know, I've laid out a scenario. I've acknowledged that I have a problem. I have an issue that I'd like support and healing. And then a step four is, do you have any ideas that will support me in my healing process? That's the strict meaning of that step. It doesn't go outside of that realm. What, you know, it might be, you know, your suggestion might be, let's do a worksheet together, let's breathe, let's do the commitment, let's do, you know, a codependent sheet, let's, so that
Michael,
would be what that one's
I think
about.
That's number
yes,
five.
Ma'am.
Do you have any ideas with number five?
Okay, I understood what? You to say that what you're asking for.
Number five.
I don't have the sheet in front of me,
yeah,
but you,
how is
that's
it different
why
from number five?
Funny.
Maybe that's what I need to ask. Because in number five it says, do you have any ideas?
Right.
And so I guess I'm not sure what number four is. Is it to set the person up for number five? That I want your support in helping me to heal this? And then number five, do you have any ideas?
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with the question was that you were asking something of them. That's why I was asking for clarification.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought that recently, sometime during the summer, I heard you referring to step four, what I want, and that is where you could request something of the other person.
Oh.
And that was the first time I heard it. So did I miss
okay.
this
what
here?
What I want is support in my healing. So in that step,
okay.
I'm being really clear that my request, as opposed to I want you to change or something external needs to change, that step is
right.
about clarifying my issue and then asking for support in healing that issue and being really clear. The only way place to go for a request in that is the request for support in my healing process. And then
okay.
in
okay.
step five would be the specific of what might that look like, the worksheet or what have you.
Gotcha. All right, fine. Well, then I heard the wrong thing or whatever. So thank you
okay.
very much for the clarification. All right, thank you so much.
Cool.
You guys all have
all
a
right.
wonderful weekend and continue with your. Well, this is the last day, isn't it? It's been a great week for the. Our subject and topic that you've been talking about. So continue. Okay.
No,
all
I
right.
hear your voice, Magda.
You too. Yeah, you did a great job. Take care, dear.
I miss you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you.
All right, blessings. And, you know, it ties, that whole question ties right in with exactly what we're talking about with the inventory, because I'm really sitting in front of a sponsor asking them to reflect to me what they see that is my work so that I can get clear on what I'm in block to truth about and what I need to clean up inside of me. So, you know, in the context of the communication, did you hear what I think I said, workshop, what we point out is that oftentimes all that people are interested in is problem solving. You know, gee, you came home, you frightened me, I'm scared, it's your fault. How about if you never come home like that again? I'm going to solve that problem. Where the clarity is to shift out of, I'm going to solve the problem that you caused by coming home that way. The clarity is, I want to step into my healing. So I realize that you came home a certain way, and maybe I could point out and prove to you that it's inappropriate, but that's beside the point. The truth is, I went into fear. So what I'm looking to do is to understand the root of my fear and to heal the root of my fear. And so what I'm asking for in that step is always, in the focal point being, always looking for support in my healing process as opposed to the change that I think will make it all go away and then I won't have to deal with it.
Absolutely.
So it fits very well with this right here at this juncture with the inventory and having that person in front of me that can really, truly, having done their work, hold the space for me to go through that piece of my work. It's pretty awesome.
And they share, and I share when I listen to Fifth Steps, I share my experience as well. I don't become an expert on this. You know, I share my experience because we have the same experiences and how that went and what I did in order to, you know, make that better for myself. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the confidentiality is most definitely very, very, very important.
Yes.
All the steps are very sacred, but this is a very sacred step to maintain that confidence of somebody else's and, you know, basically die with that information.
To me also, one of the things that really makes someone highly skilled at listening to that fifth step is the ability to really listen to people's words and reflect those words back to them. If
Absolutely.
We know how to listen, people will always tell us exactly what the core problem is. We don't have to figure it out. We just need to listen to their words. It's encoded in those words. And if we know how to listen and reflect those back, if someone's in the denial process in the middle of it, you know, and they say, well, and this person was just so snotty and no, it's like, okay, so let's go back to now. When have you been snotty? Tell me about that. and just, you know, bingo, there it is.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And
Absolutely.
That goes back to the first century. You go back to Romans where they say, beware you who judge another, for that in which you judge another, you have been guilty of practicing.
Absolutely.
How could they say that? Because you got to have the brain cells before you can see it. You know, as it's said popularly, I think, in the 12-step programs, if you spot it, you got it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, can't see it
absolutely.
Without the brain cells. It's a bummer, isn't it?
It is a bummer. It can be a bummer, but it could also be what sets us free by seeing it and acknowledging
it. Yeah, the good
it.
News and the bad news.
You got it, but you could get rid of it. But anyway, we continue on to 6 and 7. That is pretty quick. And I just want to point out that 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 are coupling steps. 6 and 7 go together. 8 and 9 go together. And 6 and 7 would be, and I wanted to say it perfectly, but I don't have my page open, is that we, in step 6, we are entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And then step 7 is we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And the reason why I call them coupling steps is in step 6, we become willing, and in step 7, we do. Same thing for 8 and 9. And 8, we become willing to make amends to them all. And then in step 9, we make amends. And the words character defects and shortcomings, a lot of people didn't know what these were. And I was listening for the longest time. I was listening to Joe and Charlie, who are circuit speakers for Alcoholics Anonymous. They said that they didn't know what they meant either. And then they finally went back to a relative of the lady that Bill Wilson was doing dictation to write the manuscript for the big book. And she said that they're errors in thought, they're thinking errors. One of the little quirks that Bill Wilson had is that he took a night course after he fought in World War I, and he came home, obviously a veteran, at a very young age, and he started to go to night school. And when he went to night school and took his English class or his composition class, his teacher told him that he was an idiot because he repeated too many words. So what he does in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of people curse him, is that he uses all different kind of words. He most definitely got his thesaurus out and changed all the words up. And so basically character defects and shortcomings are the same. And that they're thoughts and error, or errors in thought. And we ask God to remove these because we can't work on them. If we start to work on them, then it's basically ego or working on ego or self working on self, or what Albert Einstein says, that the mind that caused the problem can't solve it. It would be working on our character defects is trying to maintain that same mind. So asking them to have them removed is what we do in 6 and 7. Become willing and then do it. And there is a prayer. There is a question in step 6, and the question in step 6 is, are we ready to let go of what we have found is objectionable? So we see our character defects in the 4th column in the resentment part of the 4th step. We talk about them in step 5, and then we get to the place we ask ourselves, are we ready to let go of these? And I ask myself this every day, am I ready to let go of everything that I find that is objectionable? And it's usually a resounding hell yeah. The only thing that I want to hang on to is my sarcasm. I like it. the rest of the character defects, I am willing to let go of. And then there.
So let me throw a thought in here.
Okay.
I'd offer the reason why so many people utilize sarcasm is because it's one of the most powerful non-substance drugs that there is.
Oh, it's a drug.
Sarcasm is our culture's socially acceptable way of expressing otherwise unexpressible rage. And rage is the deepest level of hostility as a drug that there is. So when one can come up with that cutting remark, it's very much tied to a deep sense of rage that, as it shows up in the structure chemically, is a very powerful anesthetic. And the clock just told me that we're down to about 60 seconds, so
okay.
Maybe we can hold that thought.